You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Ronald Brownstein, the American journalist, political correspondent, and analyst, joins me this week, and he's the author of many books, including The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America, and Power and the Glitter, the Washington, Hollywood-Washington Connection. And his new book is called Rock Me on the Water, 1974, the year Los Angeles transformed movies, music, television, and politics. Ron Brownstein, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
Hi. I was there. I lived in Los Angeles in 1974.
Ah.
I went to the Troubadour. I did a lot of those things that I read about in your book. So it was. I even was present at a taping of All in the Family. And of course, I watched all the shows and things that you talked about.
Now, the night that you were there, did they do it twice?
No, they did it one time. But they did actually bring out a piano and play the song.
Wow. And did Norman come out and warm up the crowd, which he often did?
Yeah, I can't remember if that happened or not.
Mm. You know, because as I say in the book, there were some nights they did it twice and even changed it between the first one and the second one. If a line didn't work or something, and then they spliced them together on the air. I mean, it really was as Larry Gelbart said, it was factory work putting out a sitcom then with 20 plus episodes a season.
Yeah.
And now if we get 10, we feel we're overworking them.
Right. And even then that was less than, 10 years earlier. I think there's like when the Twilight Zone was on, they had like 32 episodes.
Wow. Wow.
But, and I also, I saw the Eagles at the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium mm-hmm. in 73. And I saw Linda Ronstadt when she was playing with them a little earlier in Pasadena when they were her band. And I saw Jackson Browne in 1974, and I saw all those people.
Well, Jackson Browne and Linda Ronstadt toured together, as I wrote about in the book, in 1974, and alternated who was the headliner based on their assessment of who had sold more records in each market.
Yeah, I remember it well. So anyway, I found your book to be very nostalgic and fun to read, and the points that you raised were really interesting. So your book argues that the ideals of the 1960s kind of became mainstream in America in 1974. Why 1974 and not 73 or 75?
Yeah, well, as I say in the book, I mean, I'm not suggesting this was a one-year process, the cultural eras begin and end following our calendar. Obviously, what happened was a multi-year process. I think, though, I picked 1974 as the culmination of a process that stretches back to the late 60s, and also kind of the fragile moment before things began to move in a different direction, very clearly in 1975 and 1976. I mean, basically, my story is that in the early 1970s in L.A., there was an incredible confluence of talent, as you know, from what we were just discussing, that simultaneously there was the revitalization of the movie industry. The 60s had been a really rough decade for Hollywood. They lost a lot of money and didn't make a lot of good movies. But beginning in the late 60s and then especially in the early 1970s, we had what I think is pretty widely considered the second golden age, along with World War II in Hollywood, with this tremendous outpouring of kind of socially aware movies, from Five Easy Pieces to the Carnal Knowledge, the Godfather movies, to Chinatown, Conversation, Shampoo, et cetera. And as we were noting, simultaneous to that, television was fundamentally transformed. I mean, like the studios, and we'll probably talk about this more, but even more so, the networks had spent the 60s ignoring everything that was happening around them in society. I mean, they gave us the Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction, and we didn't get any closer to Vietnam than McHale's Navy and Gomer Pyle. But in the early 1970s, that wall started to come down, and you got the really historic generation of kind of socially aware and contemporary comedies, MASH, Mary Tyler Moore, and above all in the Family, and others like the Jeffersons and Good Times and Chico and the Man, and you know, all of that that happened. And then there was also really the apex of the Southern California sound. I mean, this was the point at which the artists who were kind of clustered mostly around David Geffen and Asylum Records, whether it was Joni Mitchell, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, the Eagles, had their maximum influence. And my, you know, that, and that's what's originally, you know, Gary, what drew me to this story. I mean, I was just attracted to the idea of all of this happening at once in the same time, in the same place. And it seemed like, and as I've talked to people, it was an incredibly fun and creative period, but there was something deeper also, which is, you know, I do think this was a period that was a hinge in America's cultural and political life, because it was in these works of pop culture in the early 70s that a lot of the ideas that emerged out of the 60s social movements really were cemented into pop culture, never to be dislodged. And in that way, pop culture was kind of the bridge from ideas that once seemed insurrectionary in the 60s to the mass American audience in the 70s and beyond.
And the fact that it's in LA, I mean, there had sort of been in 1967, maybe San Francisco was the focus. And in the past and in the future, New York, the focus of American culture. Why do you think it just blossomed in LA at that moment?
It's a really good question. I think if I had to give one answer, and the word that people kept using about LA in that time was open. It was open. It was, you know, Irving Azoff, the manager of the Eagles, talked to me about when he got out of when he was leaving Illinois and he was deciding whether to, you know, where to kind of point his car to for his career. And he thought about New York and he thought about LA and he thought New York was a closed shop. You know, Mary Kay Place, who the actress and writer, said something almost identical to me. Linda Ronstadt talked about, you know, coming out to LA a few years earlier in the mid 60s and just feeling that there was an energy. You know, she kind of went to see the bands on Sunset Strip and she was like, okay, this is where I have to be. Neil Young talked about that, coming to LA and ultimately, forming, Buffalo Springfield. Obviously it, for Hollywood, it kind of made sense in that, you know, that was always the center of the artistic part of the industry. But for all of these industries, whether we're talking about TV, whether we're talking about movies, whether we're talking about music, I think there was a sense that LA in those years was really open to new ideas and new approaches. I mean, you know, if you think about MASH, for an example, just, you know, which is, you know, not the most, I'd say All in the Family is the most pathbreaking, but MASH was a comedy in which people would die on the operating table. And that was not something we had seen before. And it was not something that CBS was entirely sure it wanted. But there was a sense of openness and a willingness to try things. I mean, Linda Ronstadt and Jackson Browne and the Eagles were looking at ways to take sounds that were kind of separate and merge them together in new ways. Jackson Browne told me this great story about Glenn Frey being the first person he ever heard playing Sweet Little 16 on an acoustic guitar, you know, the Chuck Berry song. And then thinking, wow, you can do that. And I think that was kind of the dominant, impulse in LA in those years. You know what? You can do that. You can try that. You can try new things. You can put things together in different combinations. You know, I was talking to someone. I was doing an appearance the other day with Walter Mosley, and we were talking about how, you know, Easy Rollins, his great character, as a detective, like most detectives, ultimately figures it out. I mean, he does solve the crime. It's not that justice is always done, but he does figure out what's happened. You know, in the movies in LA in the early 70s, I mean, Chinatown, Jack Nicholson precipitates tragedy because he never figures it out, or only figures it out until too late. And that was common. I mean, so or Little Big Man from Arthur Penn, you know, kind of inverting all of the classic Westerns. So I think the answer is that it was a period of just enormous fluidity. And obviously there were still all sorts of constraints As we'll talk about, you know, women and people of color, their stories were being shown more on the screen. They weren't necessarily given more control of those stories behind the screen. But overall, it was a period in which the city, all of these industries were open to new ideas and new approaches. And in that kind of narrow time frame, just an explosion of creativity poured through.
But you bring politics into it too, with Jerry Brown and yep. Tom Hayden and Jane Fonda. I guess Jane Fonda is entertainment politics.
Yes.
Why was LA a political center too? What was LA?
Yeah. But by the way, one last to that last conversation we're having. I mean, I was thinking, I was talking about the Jackson Brown story. Paul Schrader said something to me, the writer and director, that again really encapsulated this sense. He said that, you know, when he was trying to start out as a screenwriter, Francis Ford Coppola, who he knew, said to him, just go in there and tell them you know how to do it. You know how to make movies that young people are going to like. You know how to make them a lot of money, because they don't know. They know that what they were doing isn't working anymore. They don't know that you don't know. Right. And they don't know that, you know, they think that you might. And that was kind of the, you know, kind of citywide in all of these cultural industries. There was a sense that the old formulas weren't working. We needed something new, especially true in movies and television. And so they were willing to experiment in a way they hadn't been before. And, you know, where the politics comes in is that I think that the central issue, you know, obviously, there's a lot of movies, there's a lot of TV, there's a lot of music, and they all are touching on different things. But if there is a central issue that the great pop culture produced in LA in the early 1970s was grappling with, it was, I think, the question of what from the ideals of the 60s could be preserved in what was clearly a kind of stonier political soil of the 1970s. It was pretty clear by the early 70s that we were not going to have some sort of fundamental social revolution that was going to, you know, Tom Hayden was writing about, you know, in 71 or 70. So the question was, what of the ideals of a more equitable society, a more inclusive society, could be made relevant? And what I thought was so interesting was that Jerry Brown's election in 1974 as governor of California really is the first time that you have a political figure running for a major office who is grappling with those same questions. I mean, and he is kind of road testing. What can you take from the ideals of the 60s, more environmental concern, more focus on inclusion of women and minorities, more kind of sensitivity to the age of limits idea. Like what from these ideals could you take and kind of fashion them into a construct that could actually win an election? And in 74, he began to answer that question. I guess Gary Hart in Colorado would have been the other figure, really for the first time, bringing these ideas into the mainstream political world. I say in the book that California Democratic primary in 1974 between Jerry Brown and two older Hubert Humphrey kind of style Democrats who had no idea what to make of him at all, could not fathom what he was talking about. It was sort of like one long episode of All in the Family between Archie and Mike. It was the generation gap kind of condensed in All in the Family to a single living room. In this case, kind of played out in a single political campaign.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and tonight we're talking with Ron Brownstein. He's a political correspondent. You've seen him on CNN. He's the author of several books, including The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America, and The Power and the Glitter, The Hollywood-Washington Connection. His new book is called Rock Me on the Water, 1974, The Year Los Angeles Transformed Movies, Music, Television, and Politics.
I was mentioning your other books, and you have a book about the polarization. And I know it's something that you've talked about a lot on CNN and everywhere else about our current political situation. And even though America was greatly divided over the Vietnam War and Nixon and Agnew and all of that, there wasn't that great polarization of, I mean, I think both parties realized and honored the fact that both parties had the same goal, which was to make America a better place. And they just had different ways of going about achieving that goal. Whereas today, we absolutely don't have that agreement or understanding.
Yes. Well, I think, yeah, absolutely right. And I think the principal reason that we are more polarized today than we were then is rooted in the phenomena that I am talking about in this book. And that is that we've gone from, if you go back to the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the cleavage between the parties, the fault line between the parties was class primarily. I mean, basically most people somewhere, you know, you draw a line somewhere in the income ladder, most people above it reliably voted Republican, most people below it reliably voted Democratic. There were lots of culturally conservative Democrats. All those Southern evangelicals were still voting Democratic. There were a lot of culturally conservative Catholics in the, you know, in the Northeast and the Midwest who were still voting Democratic. And there were a lot of socially liberal, you know, what we call it, the silk stocking district in New York, John Lindsay kind of style Republicans who were culturally liberal, but still voted Republican, either because of economics or just because of just,
I mean, you know, even Barry Goldwater,
was the party of WASPs.
Even Barry Goldwater was even Barry, more,
right.
was more so, liberal
but,
than that.
You know, all of the changes that really convulsed American society in the 60s lit a bomb under that political alignment. And starting with the Civil Rights Acts, continuing with all the debates about the role of women and changing attitudes about sex, debates about crime. We essentially, starting in the 60s, we began what has really been a 50-year process of replacing our class-based political alignment with one that's based on cultural attitudes, right? So, you know, as I think 2012 was the first time I used these phrases, I believe that the fundamental fault line in our politics now is between what I call a coalition of transformation and a coalition of restoration, Democratic coalition of transformation, the voters who are most comfortable with the way the country is changing demographically and culturally, Republican coalition of restoration, most uncomfortable. And these, once politics was aligned in this way, we separated. I mean, like we like physically separated. I mean, Democrats now are strong in every metro area in the country, in the reddest state and in the, I mean, you know, yes, they dominate New York and Minneapolis and Denver. They also now dominate Houston and Dallas and San, you know, and increasingly Atlanta. So the parties are living kind of separate lives, separated precisely by the kind of cultural change that, you know, that I write about in Rock Me on the Water. And so I think this world there, you know, in that old world, there was a lot of ideological ramshackleness to the parties. I mean, there were moderate Republicans and liberal Republicans and conservative Republicans, and there were very conservative Democrats. Now, all the cherries on the slot machine line up in a way that causes you to see less of yourself across the line, you know, and as what you were saying, both parties shared that view that the other, you know, was working for the betterment of the country overall. That is not the case anymore. If you look at polling, there are, you know, roughly 90% of people in each party, I think, during the election said it would, you know, essentially it would be catastrophic for America if the other side won in last November's election. And a lot of reasons for that. But the biggest single reason, I think, is that we now have a culture-based political alignment. And that is a big bang that was set off in the 1960s.
Rooted in All in the Family.
Or at least reflected in All in the Family, right? I mean, like what was the macro storyline of All in the Family? It was the terms of surrender by the older generation to the new cultural rules being set by the younger generation. Archie loved Nixon. Nixon won 49 states in 1972, and yet Archie still felt his America was slipping away. I mean, that was kind of the story, you know, and you know, it didn't necessarily come through that way to audiences. I mean, Norman Lear and the people running the show felt, John Rich, the director, talked about this. They felt that Archie was always supposed to be on the losing end of every argument, whether he was arguing with a younger person or a Black person or a gay person or a Jewish person. You know, Archie's worldview was always supposed to be shown to be, you know, blinkered and deficient. But that isn't necessarily the way the audience viewed it. And one of the reasons why All in the Family was such a success is that unlike something like the Smothers Brothers a few years earlier, it didn't fully pick a team in the generational divide. I mean, there were lots of people who watched it because they liked hearing what Archie said out loud, which they had previously only muttered under their breath. My dad, I grew up in Queens. I grew up not far from Astoria where the show was set. My dad was an electrician. He loved Archie. You know, I mean, he didn't think Archie was losing his arguments with Mike. Norman Lear and John Rich and the screenwriters may have thought that, but I'm not sure all the listeners saw that. And, you know, my point in Rock Me on the Water and just more broadly, it's not that the 60s left dominated American politics. In fact, Nixon won two elections by mobilizing the voters most unhappy with it. Reagan won elections in the 80s, mobilizing voters unhappy with the way society was changing. But the victory was cultural. I mean, even after Nixon won, even after Reagan won, we didn't go back to the 1950s. We didn't go back to Donna Reed and Fathers Knows Best. Women didn't go back to the kitchen. You know, Black people didn't go back to less assertive, expressions less assertive kind of demands for inclusion in American society. You can win elections by mobilizing against the way society is changing. What you can't do really is stop the changes.
The transformation is going to continue no matter what.
Right. And I think pop culture is the canary in the coal mine there. Right. I mean, as we just said, I mean, it is an irony that precisely as these ideas like greater suspicion of authority, greater autonomy for women, more inclusion of marginalized groups, rethinking attitudes about sex and marriage, even as these ideas, precisely as these ideas are triumphing in popular culture, Nixon is twice winning election by mobilizing the voters who least like all of them. And yet that did not stop the ideas from taking root and changing the way we live. And I think that to me is the, you know, is one of the most important points of kind of studying this period. I mean, if you look at the ideas that were migrating into popular culture, they were a better predictor of how we were actually going to be living in 10 years in the 80s and 90s than the election returns were. And I think that's true again today. I mean, Trump, like Nixon, has shown there is a big constituency you can mobilize by promising to stop the way society is changing. But I don't think he's going to have any more success than Nixon did at stopping those actual changes. And if you look at pop culture today and kind of the radically inclusive panoramic view of diversity, not only accepting difference, celebrating difference, I don't think in 10 years we're going to be arguing about transgender rights any more than we are arguing today about gay marriage like we were 15 years ago. I think the trajectory here is unmistakable. It doesn't mean the left's always going to win elections, but it does mean that those who want to kind of stop the way society is changing really are highly, highly, highly unlikely to actually do so.
They're going to be frustrated ultimately.
Yeah, and frustration can be a powerful political tool, but the underlying reality is going to change.
There was an episode of MASH that I thought was particularly interesting in that 1974 season when you talked about that incredible lineup that CBS had of All in the Family and MASH and Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart and Carol Burnett.
Pretty good night.
Yeah, a great night of television. And there's an episode of MASH where Hawkeye, who is a womanizer, mm-hmm. and wants almost more than anything, you know, he wants women. And he is about to bed a nurse, and it turns out that she's a racist. She uses the term gook and he loses all interest in her and gets up and leaves. That is that his politics trumped his sexuality.
Well, it's interesting. I had not fastened on that particular episode. I talked about others, but that is a really good point because, you know, they dialed down Hawkeye's womanizing as the series went on. And even the TV version of it was a dialed back version of the movies. And, you know, I think they dialed it back for a lot of reasons, but one of them is that, you know, a fair amount of their comedy was kind of based on anachronism. I mean, Alan Alda portraying the prototypical sensitive 70s male dropped back into kind of a 50s world and showing up the kind of troglodyte attitudes around him. But in that way, I mean, all of this just kind of underscored All in the Family. I mean, excuse me, MASH was a series about Vietnam while we were still in Vietnam under the thinnest veil of, you know, setting it in Korea. And I think Larry Gelbart once said, or Gene Reynolds, I forget, Gene Reynolds and Larry Gelbart were the two who created one or the other said, like, the most amazing thing about MASH was that it got on at all. Right. I mean, it was that they allowed them to do this. MASH came along. By the way, MASH first went on the air about 6 weeks before Nixon won his 49 states. And again, gives you this contrast between the way the electorate is moving at that moment, but the way these ideas are just kind of lampooning military authority and authority in general were advancing despite kind of the electoral setback. One of the CBS executives at the time said, you know, after All in the Family, everything else was easy to digest. CBS seemed a little like CBS with MASH and, you know, Mary Tyler Moore didn't push the buttons as much, but MASH certainly did. CBS was like a parent who just did not have the stomach for wars with the younger sibling after battling out with the older one about, you know, getting home on time and, you know, son, you're going to drive me to drinking if you don't stop driving that hot rod, like, and all that. I mean, All in the Family was that. That was the battle royale for years, even after they put it on the air. And I think MASH kind of slid along they were kind of drafting on that.
I think Mary Tyler Moore was more subversive in a way that didn't become clear until later. You know, there's an episode where she says, you know, did you not give me this promotion, Mr. Grant, because I'm a woman? And he said, of course.
Right. That is the classic episode. I mean, that is, you know, when Mary Tyler Moore finally, I mean, James L. Brooks got a lot of crap from feminists, actually, who thought that that she was too deferential. James L. Brooks, the creator with Alan Burns. There were a lot of feminists who thought that Mary Richards, the character played by Mary Tyler Moore, was too deferential to Lou Grant, played by Ed Asner. And she called him, for example, Mr. Grant, when everybody else in the newsroom called him Lou. And their defense was that they believe that's what this person would do. I mean, this character would do. But even within that constraint, there is an undeniable evolution of the character over the course of the seven seasons. And she and, you know, if you look at that first season, it does ring a little anachronistic to us because it focuses very heavily on Mary's dating life. And even though they went to great struggle with CBS, you know, the story is that they wanted her to be divorced and CBS absolutely refused. But even having her be single and identifiably in her 30s, CBS didn't want to let them identify an age. You know, I mean, like I think someone said, how no one ever knew how old Lucy was. But they got that level of reality. The first season, still kind of very traditional. A lot of it is about her dating life. But as it goes on, she becomes a more assertive, independent person, kind of tracking the changes in society itself. And obviously, you point to that one huge moment where she asks Lou Grant for a raise. I cite another example. You know, as I said, when they created the show and they went into this hellish meeting at CBS in New York, they absolutely refused to let her be divorced to the point where they wanted Grant Tinker to fire the two of them because they were suggesting that she be divorced. If you fast forward a few years later, they spin off Rhoda to her own show. They marry her because they get her married because Fred Silverman thought that would be a ratings bonanza, and it was, but it kind of strangled the show. So they decided that Rhoda had to get divorced in order to kind of give them a last chance on life. And this time,
nobody cared.
Nobody cared. So it was, you know, that's the way that look, you know, you don't get the sudden revolution in American society very often. You get that kind of change. But Rhoda's divorce versus the divorce that never happened for Mary is a marker of how much the position of women and attitudes about family had changed between 1970 and the mid 70s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Ronald J. Brownstein. His new book is called Rock Me on the Water, 1974, the year Los Angeles transformed movies, music, television, and politics. And we were talking before the break about how society's values had transformed during the early 1970s.
Well, I was talking the other day with Jennifer Cation Armstrong about how Madonna's performance in 1984, 85 on MTV when she was rolling around in her wedding dress, and how shocking it was. And you compare that to Megan Thee Stallion at this year's Grammy Awards.
Yes.
You know, like, well, you know, Madonna seems awfully tame compared. And of course, in terms of language and things that people use, I mean, I remember, well, not only did they not curse much in the movies, even though they could in the 1970s. I mean, there were some exceptions like The Last Detail.
The Last Detail would be, I was going to say.
Or The Boys in the Band. But people didn't curse as much on the street as they do now. I mean, The Exorcist, which was a very, very popular movie in 1973, 74, and there was lines around the block at the National Theater in Westwood. Go see that picture. And one of the shocking things about that movie was this little girl who's a teenager, you know, she's middle school age, spewing this obsessivity out of her. Whereas, you know, I was a middle school teacher for 28 years. You just walk to lunch and you can hear the same obscenities coming out of middle school mouths all the time now. So it wouldn't particularly be as shocking as it
not necessarily a step forward in I mean, the general in American society, look, the general trajectory clearly, you know, after the 1960s has been toward greater personal freedom, right? In every sphere of your life. And there are costs to that. I mean, there are things that were lost. But obviously there were benefits, and you know, one of the interesting things, and obviously I write a lot about this in the book, is that in many ways, these ideas, these critiques of American life, that it was too conformist, that it was too straitjacketed, plastics, you know, from The Graduate.
Yes.
These were brought to the screen and to TV. Music is different, but just to TV and movies, primarily by the older generation. Right. It was directors like Mike Nichols and Arthur Penn and Bob Rafelson and certainly Robert Altman and then Norman Lear who are kind of pressing this forward. And it's striking that when the baby boomers themselves come onto the scene, by and large, they are not interested in fighting these fights as much as the older generation were, who spent years kind of banging their head against Hollywood and finally had the door open in this brief window. You know, Spielberg, Lucas, Scorsese, they looked back to almost a 40s conception of Hollywood, where you would make thrilling movies, you know, that people would cheer for heroes and hiss at villains. I mean, Lucas gives this speech. He makes American Graffiti, and in his notes for the screenplay says, "Why can't things stay the way they are?" It's a movie set very self-consciously before all of the changes of the 60s, right? I mean, you know, that it's kind of the end of that world. I mean, in the same way that, you know, I'm saying that the early 70s is kind of the culmination of the 60s, the early 60s is kind of the end of the 50s, and he's celebrating that. And when the movie comes out and it's a huge hit, he goes up to Modesto, where he's from, and he gives a speech in which he says to the Chamber of Commerce, the Rotarians, I think, and he says, "I was tired of going to see movies where I came out of the theater feeling worse than when I went in," which was, you know, kind of his critique of the Altman, Rafelson, Penn kind of filmmaking. And in many ways provided the mission statement for what the next generation of directors did. I mean, Spielberg obviously eventually got to a different place, but in those years of Jaws and Close Encounters and E.T. and Raiders, he is animated by the sheer joy and brilliance of his filmmaking capacity, and obviously Star Wars as well, as opposed to this desire that you see in that older generation in the early 70s, like tear down the myths that Hollywood had built up. I mean, very conscious of doing that, these movies, whether it's Chinatown or Little Big Man, you know, just the idea that the hero doesn't always get parallax view, the hero doesn't always get it right, the hero can, you know, feet of clay, America sort of fundamentally corrupt. Nashville, to me, is the in some ways, the culmination of all the movies of the early 70s. So it's a strange generational inversion that drove the Hollywood of that era.
Nashville was such a prescient film. I remember that in December 1980, when John Lennon was killed, The next day, there were a lot of people being interviewed in the press, and one of them was Robert Altman, and he said that he wasn't in the least bit shocked. He was greatly saddened, but not shocked, because he made a film about it.
Yes, he did. Nashville, like, so Nashville is not the best movie of the early 1970s. We would agree. I think most people put both Godfathers and Chinatown, at least, and maybe some of the others above it. But to me, it's kind of the Moby Dick of early 1970s Hollywood, because it is the attempt to cram into one artistic statement all of the major themes of the era: political corruption and alienation, free-floating violence, a suspicion of authority. Just like America just seems to be coming apart at the seams in this movie. And what's, you know, as I treat it in the book, it's being filmed at exactly the same time as Jaws. Yeah. And it comes out at the same time as Jaws. They come out about 10 days apart in June 75. Jaws is on the cover of Time. Nashville is on the cover of Newsweek. And, you know, Nashville is not the last movie even that had an early 70s sensibility. I mean, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest and Network, Coming Home even later. But I do think that is a hinge point, right? I mean, Nashville is sort of the end of something.
And Jaws marks the end of that, yeah.
Yep. And they had not really been kind of seen in that kind of bookended way as I treat them in the book. But yeah. I think they very much do kind of show you the hinge in Hollywood and the beginning of the movement away. Obviously, you mentioned The Exorcist and Godfather and The Sting had all showed that you could make more money than people thought on a movie that was a big hit. But Jaws then raised that, you know, took that and raised it. Star Wars a few years later raised it again. And once you got in that world where the roulette wheel could pay off that much bigger, there was kind of less interest in making the conversation, you know.
Or Five Easy Pieces. So.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
A movie that had virtually no plot, but was just a really interesting movie. Right. But do remind us what Robert Altman said when he was asked why he thought Nashville did not perform as well as other pictures.
Yeah, he kind of hemmed and hawed. He said, well, you know, people described it as a masterpiece and maybe that, you know, put off audiences. They don't like that word. But in the end, my problem was I didn't have a shark. And that would really become the lament, right, of that generation of directors over the next 20 years. I mean, they made good movies. I mean, Mike Nichols made some good movies and, you know, Altman, well, after Nashville, it took him a long time until The Player. Beatty made Reds, you know, and there were individual moments, high points, but it was a sense that these were kind of epilogues to an earlier triumph and that the wheel had turned toward the blockbuster, not only the special effects blockbuster, but, you know, January 75 is the formation of Creative Artists Agency, which is about kind of the, you know, the packaged movie that had a lot of high priced talent in it and thus had to be kind of a main out of Africa or something like that. What's the Dustin Hoffman, Tom Cruise?
Rain Man.
Rain Man, right. So, you know, so the whole thing moves toward bigger movies that need bigger returns. And I do wonder, by the way, if the streaming revolution combined with the unprecedented and, you know, overdue pressure on Hollywood to be more inclusive, whether it does allow a return towards some of the more personal and socially aware filmmaking. Because if you're making things for Netflix or Hulu or, you know, any of these, you don't necessarily have to open, you know, 2,000 theaters and make $400 million. It may be we may have a revival of the idea of lower budgets in return for more control and more personal imprint, which was essentially the trade that the studios made with the filmmakers in the early 1970s.
It's a very similar situation in music. That is, the record labels no longer dominate how we listen to music anymore, and people don't buy records. Stream or whatever. And so, you know, when Jackson Brown, for instance, hit it big and Steve Noonan didn't, you know, Steve Noonan was there. He could have been the next Jackson Brown, but he wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, the record companies make those decisions. But now that's not true. I mean, anybody that can get anybody to listen to them on YouTube or wherever they're making their music, then people listen to them and they become a star on their own. Right. Let's come back to Jackson Brown, though, because your book is called Rock Me on the Water.
Yes.
And you did some insightful analysis of his lyrics, particularly between the albums Late for the Sky and and The Pretender, that there's a sort of change in in his philosophy. Can you talk a little
bit? Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, I think the dominant, if there was a unifying question in pop culture in the early 1970s, it was what of the ideals of the 60s could be sustained into the 70s. And Jackson Browne wrote one song on each of his first three albums that directly grappled with that question. The first album and the first song was Rock Me on the Water, which I took as my title. And, you know, he says, oh, people, look among you. It's there your hope must lie, you know, and he is still optimistic. He is still kind of bugling or you know, summoning society to come together and make America a better place. You know, there are images of towers are turning, you know, towers are burning, walls are falling. But by and large, it's still an optimistic vision. You get to the second album and the title song is For Every Man. And it, by now, he's kind of hedging his bets a little. Like, For Every Man, by the way, Every Man is his phrase for the collective social movements of the 60s. And by now, he is waiting for Every Man. You know, he's kind of like waiting. The song was born in kind of his dialogue with David Crosby, who would his friend in CSN, who was a big sailor and always said, like, if it all went to hell, he would just kind of sail away on his boat. And Jackson Browne would say to him, well, that's great, but what about everybody who can't afford a yacht? And his answer was the title song For Every Man. And he's still waiting here for Every Man, although he allows in that song that he may be just holding sand in the end. It's a beautiful image, you know, that it may never come to be. And then on Late for the Sky, you get Before the Deluge, in which there, you know, it's Watergate, it's 1974, the 60s are receding further in the rearview mirror. There is just less hope for change. And instead now he is kind of predicting, you know, he has his images of biblical and environmental reckoning and apocalypse. And that does kind of extend forward into The Pretender, the song The Pretender itself. You know, when he writes of the 60s, you know, I want to know what became of the changes we waited for love to bring. Were they only the fitful dreams of some greater awakening? So he is still at a moment where he's like kind of lamenting what didn't happen. But really, what happens in his life is sort of emblematic of what happens in the lives of millions of other people from the kind of who were marinated in the social movements of the 60s, is that as he went forward, he found ways to look forward more often than he looked back. And he found causes that engaged him. He found, you know, he made artistic statements that engaged him. And he didn't spend his life pining about what hadn't happened. And, you know, you could say the same thing about Fonda and Hayden. That's why I write about them, because they were further out on the edge than almost anybody in the 60s and early 70s. I mean, Fonda, you know, was literally spiraling out of control in the early 1970s. But in the story that I tell in the book, I mean, 1974 is kind of the year that she kind of climbs in off the ledge, and Hayden climbs in off the ledge. And in much the same process as Jackson Browne sings about, they find a way to kind of re-enter what, you know, what is the mainstream of American life, that they have changed. I mean, you know, America is a different place in 1978 than it is in 1965, in all the ways that we were talking about in terms of, you know, relations between women and men and role of minority groups and suspicion of authority. It's not the transformation that they envisioned, but it wasn't nothing either. And I think they found a way to build on that and to move forward. And that's why I thought the story of Hayden and Fonda was so resonant, because it was an answer in the real world to this question that I felt was being asked in all of the artistic statements of the time.
And there are so many of those stories in this book, and it's called Rock Me on the Water, 1974, the year Los Angeles transformed movies, music, television, and politics. Ron Brownstein, thank you so much for spending some time talking with us on From the Bookshelf. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Great conversation.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.